statement, then. Thrace was about to speak again, but Arista beat her to it. What happened to you? She gestured at her face. Thrace reached up, running her fingers over her forehead.
Is it that bad?
It was the Gilarabrin, Your Highness, Thomas explained. Thrace and her father, Theron, were the only two to ever survive a Gilarabrin attack. Now please, my dear girl, please get back in bed.
But really, I am feeling much better.
Let her walk with me a bit, Deacon, Arista said, softening her tone. If she feels worse, I'll get her back to bed. Thomas nodded and bowed. Arista took Thrace by the arm and led her up the hallway, Hilfred walking a few steps behind. They could not travel far, only 30 yards or so. The manor house was not a real castle. It was built from great rough-cut beams, some with the bark still on, and she guessed there were only about 8 bedrooms. In addition, there were a parlour, an office, and the great hall, with a high ceiling and mounted heads of deer and bears. It reminded Arista of a cruder, smaller version of King Rosworth's residence. The floor was made of wide pine planks, and the outer walls were thick logs. Nailed along them were iron lanterns holding flickering candles that cast semicircles of quivering light, for even though it was mid-afternoon, the interior of the manor was dark as a cave.
"You're so kind," the girl told her. "The others treat me as if I don't belong here."
"Well, I'm glad you're here," Arista replied. "Other than my handmaiden, Bernice, I think you're the only other woman here."
"It's just that everyone else was sent back home, and I feel so out of place, like I'm doing something wrong. Deacon Thomas says I'm not. He says I'm hurt, and I need time to recover, and that he'll see to it no one bothers me. He's been very nice. I think he feels as helpless as everyone else around here. Maybe taking care of me is a battle he feels he can win."
"I misjudged the deacon," Arista told her. "And you. Are all farmers' daughters in Dahlgren so wise?"
"Wise?"
Thrace looked embarrassed. Arista smiled at her. "Where is your family?"
"My father is in the village. They won't let him in to see me, but the deacon is working on that. I don't think it matters, as we'll be leaving Dahlgren as soon as I can travel, which is another reason I want to get my strength back. I want to get away from here. I want us to find a new place and start fresh. I'll find a man, get married, have a son, and call him Hickory."
"Quite a plan. But how are you feeling, really?"
"I still have headaches. And to be honest, I'm getting a little dizzy right now."
"Maybe we should head back to your bedroom, then," Arista said, and they turned around.
"Well, I am feeling so much better than I was. That's another reason why I got up. I haven't been able to thank Ezra. I thought he might be in the halls here somewhere."
"Ezra?" Arista asked. "Is he the village doctor?"
"Oh, no. Dahlgren's never had a doctor. Ezra is, well, he's a very smart man. If it hadn't been for him, both me and my father would be dead by now. He was the one who made the medicine that saved me."
"He sounds like a great person."
"Oh, he is. I try to pay him back by helping him eat. He's very proud, you understand, and he would never ask, so I offer, and I can see he appreciates it."
"Is he too poor to afford food?"
"Oh, no. He just doesn't have any hands."
"Tur is a myth," Ezra Harden was saying to the dwarf, as Royce and Hadrian arrived at the falls.
"Says you,"
Magnus replied. The wizard and the dwarf sat on the rocky escarpment, facing each other, arguing over the roar. The sun, having dropped behind the trees, left the two in shadow, but the crystalline spires atop Avampartha caught the last rays of dying red light. Ezra Hardin sighed. I'll never understand what it is about religion that causes otherwise sensible people to believe in fairy tales. Even in the world of religion, Tur is a parable, not a reality. You're dealing with myths, based on legends, based on superstitions, and taking it literally. That is very undwarf-like. Are you certain you don't have some human blood in your ancestry?
That's just insulting, Magnus glared at the wizard. You deny it, but the proof is right before you. If you had dwarven eyes, you could see the truth in that blade.
Magnus gestured at Royce.
What's all this about? Hadrian asked. Hello, Magnus. Murder anyone lately?
The dwarf scowled.
This dwarf insists that Royce's dagger was made by Kyle, Ezra Hardin explained.
I didn't say that, the dwarf snapped. I said it was a Tur blade. It could have been made by anyone from Tur.
What's Tur? Hadrian asked.
A misguided cult of lunatics that worship a fictitious god. They named him Kyle, of all things. You'd think they could have at least come up with a better name.
I've never heard of Kyle, Hadrian said. Now, I'm not a religious scholar, but I remember what a little monk once told me. The dwarven god is Drome, the elfish god is Feral, and the human god is Maribor. Their sister, the goddess of flora and fauna, is Muriel, right? And her son, Ubalin, is the god of darkness. So, how does this Kyle fit in?
He's their father, Ezra Hardin explained.
Oh, right. I forgot about him, but his name isn't Kyle. It's Erebus or something, isn't it? He raped his daughter and his sons killed him, but he's not really dead. It didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Ezra Hardin chuckled. Religion never does.
So, who is Kyle?
Well, the cult of Tur, or Kyle, as it's also known, insists that a god is immortal and cannot die. This deranged group of people appeared during the imperial reign of Estermon II and began circulating this story that Erebus had been drunk, or whatever equivalent there is to a god, when he raped his daughter, and he was ashamed for what he did. The story goes that Erebus allowed his children, the gods, to believe they had killed him. Then he came to Muriel in secret and begged her forgiveness. She told her father that she wasn't ready to forgive him and would only do so after he did penance. She said he had to do good deeds throughout Ilan, but as a commoner, not as a god or even a king. For each act of sacrifice and kindness that she approved of, she would grant him a feather from her marvellous robe, and when her robe was gone, she would forgive and welcome him home. The Kyle legend says that ages ago a stranger came to a poor village called Tur. No one knows where it was, of course, and over the centuries its location has changed in response to various claims, but the most common legend places it in Delgos, because it was being regularly attacked by the Darker, and, of course, because of the similarities in names to the port city of Tur del Fur. The story goes that this stranger called himself Kyle, and, entering into Tur and seeing the terrible plight of the desperate villagers, taught them the art of weapon-making to help in their defence. The weapons he taught them to make were reputed to be the greatest in the world, capable of cleaving through solid iron as if it were soft wood. Their shields and armour were light and yet stronger than stone. Once he taught them the craft, they used it to defend their homes. After driving off the Darker, legend says there was a thunderclap on a cloudless day, and from the heavens a single white feather fell into Kyle's hands. He wept at the gift and bid them all farewell, never to be seen again. At least not by the residents of Tur. Throughout the various reigns of different emperors, there always seemed to be at least one or two stories of Kyle appearing here and there, doing good deeds and obtaining his feather. The legend stood out beyond all others, because the poor village of Tyr was now famous for its great weaponry.
I've never heard of a town by that name.
You aren't the only one, Esrahaddon said. So the myth experts added a page to their story, as so often happens with these ridiculous tales when they crash into the face of reality. Supposedly, the village was inundated with requests for arms. The tourists didn't feel it was right to make weapons for just anyone, so they only made a few, and only for those who had a just and good need. Powerful kings, however, decided to take the God-given craft secrets for themselves and prepared to battle for control of the village. On the day of the battle, however, the armies marched in to discover that the village of Tyr, all its inhabitants and buildings, was gone. Not a trace was left of their existence, except for a single white feather that came from no known bird.
Convenient, Hadrian said.
Exactly, the wizard replied. One mystery covered by another, but never any real evidence. Still, it doesn't stop people from believing.
For your information, Magnus spoke up, Tyr del Fur was once a dwarven city, and in my tongue, its name means Village of Tyr. And there are legends among my people of it once having been the source of great craftsmen who knew the secrets of folding metal and making great swords. Any dwarf in Elan would give his beard for the secrets of Tyr, or even the chance to study a Tyr blade. And you think Alverstone is a Tyr blade? Hadrian asked.
What did you call it?
Magnus asked, his beady eyes abruptly focusing on him.
Alverstone. That's what Royce calls his dagger, Hadrian explained.
Don't encourage him, Royce said, his eyes fixed on the tower. Where did he get this Alverstone?
The dwarf asked, lowering his voice.
It was a gift from a friend, Hadrian said. Right?
Who? And where did the friend get it from?
The dwarf persisted.
You are aware I can hear you, Royce told them.
Then, seeing something, he pointed toward Arvenpartha.
There, look.
They all scrambled up to peer at the outline of the fading tower. The sun was down now, and night was upon them. Like great mirrors, the river and the tower captured the starlight and the luminous moon. The mist from the falls appeared as eerie white fog skirting the base. Near the top of the spires, a dark shape spread its wings and flew down along the course of the river. It wheeled and circled back over the falls, catching air currents and rising higher until, with a flap of its massive wings, the beast headed out over the trees above the forest, flying toward Dahlgren.
"That's its lair?" Hadrian asked incredulously. "It lives in the tower?"
"Convenient, isn't it?"
Royce remarked,
"that the beast resides at the same place as the one weapon that can kill it."
"Convenient for whom?"
"I guess that remains to be seen," Esrahaddon said. Royce turned to the dwarf.
"All right, my little mason, shall we head to the tunnel? It's in the river, isn't it? Somewhere underwater."
Magnus looked at him surprised.
"I'm only guessing, but from the look on your face I must be right. It's the only place I haven't looked. Now, in return for your life, you'll show us exactly where."
Aristus stood with the Pickerings on the south stockade wall, watching the sunset over the gate. The wall provided the best view of both the courtyard and the hillside beyond, while keeping them above the turmoil. Below, knights busied themselves dressing in armour, archers strung their bows, horses decorated in caparisons shifted uneasily, and priests prayed to Novron for wisdom. The contest was about to commence. Beyond the wall, the village of Dahlgren remained silent. Not a candle was visible. Nothing moved. Another scuffle broke out near the gate, where the list of combatants hung on the hitching post. Arista could see several men pushing and swinging, rising dust.
"Who is it this time?" Marvin asked.
The elder Pickering leaned back against the log wall. He was in a simple loose tunic and a pair of soft shoes that day. This was the Marvin she most remembered, the carefree boy who had challenged her to stick duels back when she stood a foot taller and could overpower him, in the days when she had a mother and father, and her greatest challenge was making Linnea jealous.
"I can't tell," Fallon replied, peering down. "I think one is Sir Erlik."
"Why are they fighting?" Arista asked.
"Everyone wants a higher place on the list," Marvin replied.
"That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't matter who goes first."
"It does if the person in front of you kills the beastie before you get a chance."
"But they can't. Only the heir can kill the beast."
"You really think that?"
Marvin asked, turning around, grasping the sharpened points of the logs and peering down the outside of the wall.
"No one else does."
"Who's first on the list?"
"Well, Tobias Retnor was."
"Which one is he?" she asked.
"He's the one we told you about with the big mysterious wagon."
"There," Fannin pointed down in the courtyard, "the foppish-looking one, leaning against the smokehouse. He has a shrill voice and a superior attitude that makes you want to throttle him."
Marvin nodded. "That's him. I peeked under his tarp. There's this huge contraption made of wood, ropes, and pulleys. He managed to find the list first and sign his name. No one had a problem with it when they thought the contest was a tournament. Everyone was just itching to have a go at him. But now, well, the thought of Tobias as emperor has become a communal fear."
"What do you mean, was?"
"He got bumped," Fannin said.
"Bumped?"
"Louis Guy's idea," Marvin explained.
"The Sentinel decreed that those farther down on the list could move up via combat. Those unsatisfied with their place could challenge anyone for their position to a fight. Once issued, the challenged party could trade positions on the list or enter into combat with the challenger. Sir Endon of Chadwick challenged Tobias, who gave up his position."
"Who could blame him? Only Sir Graven had the courage to challenge Endon, but several others drew swords against one another for lesser spots.
Most expected the duels would be by points, but Guy declared battles over only who the opponent yielded, so they've gone on for hours. Many have been injured. Sir Graven yielded only after Endon pierced his shoulder. He's announced he's withdrawing, and will be leaving tomorrow, and he's not the only one. Several have already left, wrapped in bandages."
Arista looked at Fannin.
"You aren't challenging?"
Marvin chuckled. "It was kind of funny. The moment Guy made the announcement, everyone looked at us."
"But you didn't challenge?"
Fannin scowled and glared at Marvin.
"He won't let me, and my name is near the bottom."
"Adrian Blackwater told us not to sign up," Marvin explained.
"So?"
Marvin stared at his brother. "So the one man here who could take that top spot without breaking a sweat doesn't even have his name on the list. Either he knows something we don't, or he thinks he does. That's worth waiting out the first night at least. Besides, you heard Arista, it doesn't matter who goes first."
"You know who else isn't on the list?" Fannin asked.
"Lord Rufus."
"Yeah, I saw that. Thought he'd be the one to challenge Endon. It would have been worth the trip just to see that duel. He's not even out in the yard with the rest."
"He's been with the Archbishop a lot."
From their elevated position, Arista scanned the courtyard below. The light was gone from the yard, the walls and trees casting the interior in shade. Men went around lighting torches and mounting them. There were hundreds assembled within the grounds, and more outside, all gathered into small groups. They talked. Some shouted. She could hear laughter and even a bit of singing. She couldn't tell the song, but by its rhythm she guessed it was a bawdy tavern tune.
There was a lot of toasting going on. Dark figures in the failing light, broad, powerful men slamming cups together with enough force to spill foam. Above it all, on a wooden platform raised in the centre of the yard, stood Sentinel Luis Guy. He was high enough to catch the last rays of the sun and the last breaths of the evening wind. The light made his red cassock look like fire, and the wind blowing his cape lent him an ominous quality. She looked back at the brothers. Marvin had his mouth open, struggling to clear something from a back tooth with his forefinger. Fannin had his head up, looking at the sky. She was glad they were with her. It was a little bit of home in the wilderness, and she imagined the smell of apples. Arista and Ulrich had spent summer months at Drondel Fields to escape the heat of the city. She remembered how they used to climb the trees in the orchard outside the country castle and have apple fights in early autumn. The rotten apples would burst on the branches and spray pulp, soaking them until they all smelled like cider. Each tree a sovereign castle, they would make alliances. Marvin always teamed with Ulrich, shouting, "My king, my king!" Linnea paired with Fannin, wanting to protect her younger brother from the brutes, as she called them. Arista always remained on her own, fighting both groups. Even when Linnea stopped climbing trees, it became the boys against the girl. She didn't mind. She didn't notice. She didn't even think about it until now. There was so much in her head. So much she needed to sort out. It had been hard to think, bouncing around in the coach with Bernice staring at her. She desperately wanted to talk to someone, if only to hear her own words aloud. The idea that Sawley was a conspirator was growing in her mind, despite her reluctance to accept it. If Sawley could betray her father, who could be trusted? Could Ezra Hardin? Had he used her to escape? Was he responsible for her father's death? Now it seemed the old wizard was nearby, somewhere just outside the walls, perhaps, spending the night in one of the village houses. She didn't know what to do, or who to trust. Marvin found what he was looking for and flicked it from his finger over the wall. She opened her mouth to speak, hesitating to find the proper words to say. The whole trip there she had planned to discuss the issues raised at Irvinon with the Pickerings. Well, Marvin, at least. She closed her mouth and bit her lip, once more thinking back to the long-ago orchard and the smell of apples.
"There you are, Your Highness," Bernice said, rushing to her with a shawl for her shoulders. "You shouldn't be out so late. It's not proper."
"Honestly, Bernice, you should have had children when you had the chance. This preoccupation with pampering me has got to stop." The old woman only smiled warmly.
"I'm just looking after you, dear. You need looking after. This foul place is full of rough men. There is little but thin walls and the grace of the Archbishop separating them from your virtue. A lady such as yourself is a strong temptation, and given the untamed surroundings of this wilderness, it could easily drive many a good man to acts of rashness."
She glanced suspiciously at the brothers, who looked back sheepishly.
"And there are more than a few here who I couldn't even describe as good men. In a great castle, with a proper retinue, men can be kept at bay by holding them in awe of royalty. But here, my lady, in this barbaric, feral landscape, they will surely lose their heads."
"Oh, Bernice, please." "Here we go," Fannin said excitedly. As the last of the sun's light faded, the gates opened and Sir Endon and his retinue of 2 squires and 3 pages rode out, torches flaming. They trotted to the open plain, where the knight prepared to do battle. A shout rose from the crowd just then, and Arista looked up to see a dark shadow sweep across the moonlit sky. It drifted in like a hawk, a silhouette of wings and tail. The crowd murmured and gasped as it circled the castle briefly,
moving hesitantly before having its attention caught by torches waved by Sir Endan's entourage on the hillside. It folded its wings and dove, falling out of the sky like an arrow aimed at the Knight of Chadwick. Torches moved frantically, and Arista thought she heard Sir Endan level his lance and charge forward. There were screams, cries of anguish and terror, as one by one the torches in the field went out. "Next!" shouted Luis Guy. The dwarf led them up the river path to where the moon revealed a large rock protruding out toward the water. To Hadrian it looked vaguely like the dull tip of a broad spear. Magnus thumped the dirt with his boot, then pointed toward the river.
"We go in here. Swim straight down about 20 feet. There's an opening in the bank. The tunnel runs right under us, curves down, then runs under the river to the tower." "You can tell all that with your foot?" Royce asked.
Hadrian looked down at Ezra Hardin.
"How are you at swimming?"
"I can't say I've had the opportunity since," he said, lifting his arms. "But I can hold my breath a good long time. Drag me, if necessary."
"Let me go first," Royce announced, his eyes on Magnus.
He threw his coil of rope on the ground and tied one end around his waist.
"Feed this out to me, but hang on to it. I don't know how swift the current is." "There's no current here," Magnus told him. "There's an underwater shelf that juts out, creating an eddy. It's like a little pond down there."
"You'll forgive me if I don't take your word for it.
Once I'm down, I'll give 3 tugs, indicating that it's safe to follow. Tie off the end and follow the line down. If, on the other hand, I jump in and the rope runs out like you just caught a marlin, haul me back so I can personally kill him."
The dwarf sighed. Royce slipped off his cloak, and with Hadrian holding the rope, he descended into the river as if he were rappelling down the side of a wall. He dropped and vanished under the dark water. Hadrian felt the rope slip out gradually from between his fingers. At his side, Magnus showed no signs of concern. The dwarf stood with his head cocked back, looking up at the sky.
"What do you suppose it's doing tonight?" he asked.
"Eating nights would be my guess," Hadrian replied. "Let's just hope they keep the thing busy."
Deeper and deeper, the rope trolled out. Then it stopped. Hadrian watched where the line entered the water. It made a little white trail as it cut the current. Tug, tug, tug.
"That's it. He's in," Hadrian announced. "You next, little man."
Magnus glared at him.
"I'm a dwarf."
"Get in the river."
Magnus walked to the edge. Holding his nose and pointing his toes, he jumped and disappeared with a plop.
"That leaves you and me,"
Hadrian said, tying the end of the rope to a birch tree that leaned out a bit toward the river.
"You go first. I'll follow. See how well you do. If need be, I'll pull you through."
The wizard nodded, and for the first time since Hadrian had known him, he looked unsure of himself. Ezra Hardin took 3 deep breaths, rapidly blowing each out. On the 4th inhale, he held it and jumped feet first. Hadrian leapt in right after. The water was cold. Not icy or breathtaking, but colder than expected. The immediate shock caught Hadrian off guard for an instant. He kicked out with his feet, pointed his head down, and began to swim along the rope. Magnus had been right about the current. The water was still as a pond. He opened his eyes. Above him there was a faint blue-gray shimmer. Below it was black. Panic gripped Hadrian when he realized he could not see Ezra Hardin. Almost in response, a faint light appeared directly below him. The wizard's robe gave off a blue-green glow as he swam, paddling with his feet and stroking with his arms. Despite the lack of hands, he made good headway. The light from the robe revealed the river bank and the rope running down. It disappeared inside a dark hole. He watched the wizard slip through, and with his lungs starting to burn, followed him. Once inside, he kicked upward, and almost together their heads emerged from a quiet pool in a small cave. Royce had the other end of the rope tied to a rock. There was a lantern burning beside him. The single flame easily illuminated the room. The chamber was a natural cave with a tunnel leading out. Magnus stood off to the side, either studying the cavern walls or just keeping his distance from Royce. When Ezra Hardin surfaced, Royce hauled him out. "You might have had an easier time swimming if you'd taken off..." Royce stopped as he saw the wizard's robe. It was dry. Hadrian climbed out of the pool, feeling the river water drizzle down his body. He could hear the drops echoing in the cave like a rainstorm, but Ezra Hardin was exactly as he had been before entering the river. With the exception of his hair and beard, he wasn't even damp. Hadrian and Royce exchanged glances but said nothing. Royce picked up his lantern. "Coming, short stuff?" The dwarf grumbled and, taking hold of his beard with both hands, twisted a bit of water out. "You realize, my friend, dwarves are an older and far more accomplished..." "Less chatter, more walking," Royce interrupted, pointing at the tunnel. "You lead. And you're not my friend." Travelling forward, they entered into a new world. The walls were smooth and seamless, as if cut by the flow of water. The glossy surface magnified the light from Royce's lantern, making the curved interior surprisingly bright. "So, where are we?" Hadrian asked.
"Under the bank, not far below where we were standing before entering the water," Magnus told him. "The tunnel here corkscrews down."
"Incredible,"
Hadrian said, looking about him in amazement at the sparkling walls.
"It's as though we're on the inside of a diamond."
Just as the dwarf had predicted, the tunnel curved around and around, sloping down. Right about the time Hadrian lost all sense of direction, it stopped spinning and ran straight. It wasn't long before they could hear and feel the thunder of the falls. It vibrated through the stone. Here the ceiling and walls seeped water. 1,000 years of neglect had allowed stalactites of crystal to form on the ceiling, and jagged mounds of mineral deposits on the floor.
"This is a bit disturbing,"
Hadrian remarked, noticing a build-up of water on the floor that was getting deeper as they moved forward.
"Bah,"
Magnus muttered, but failed to add anything more. They slogged through the water, dodging stone spikes. Examining the walls, Hadrian noticed designs carved into them. Etchings of geometric shapes and patterns lined the corridor. Some of the more delicate lines were faded, missing, perhaps lost to the erosion of 1 billion water droplets. No words were visible, and there were no recognizable symbols. The etching appeared to be nothing more than decorative. Above, almost lost in the growing stone, were brackets for what might once have been banner poles, and on the side walls he spotted mountings for lamps. Hadrian tried to imagine how the tunnel looked before the time of Navron, when multicoloured banners and rows of bright lamps might have illuminated the causeway. It wasn't long before the tunnel pitched upward again, and they could all see a faint light. The tunnel ended at a stairway going up. The steps curved and were wide enough for them to take 2 strides before climbing the next step. When they reached the top, the star-filled sky was above them once more, and before long they stood above ground on the outcropping of rock that made up the base of the citadel. A strong wind met them. The gale was damp, filled with wet mist. They stood at the end of a short stone bridge spanning a narrow crevasse, beyond which stood the spires of the monolithic tower. It loomed above them so high it was impossible to see the top. More stairs awaited them on the far side, and they moved at a slow but even pace, staying single file, even though the stairs were wide enough for two, or even three, to walk abreast. They climbed five sets of steps, zigzagging in a half circle around the outside of the tower. As they started their sixth flight, Royce waited until they had moved to the lee of the citadel, then called a halt for them to catch their breath. Below, the roar of the falls boomed, but from their perch, protected from the wind, the night seemed still. There were no sounds, no crickets or owls, just the deep voice of the river and the howl of the wind.
"This is ridiculous!" Royce shouted over the roar. "Where's the damn door? I don't like being so exposed."
"It's just up ahead, not too much farther," Ezra Hardin replied.
"How long do we have?"
Hadrian asked, looking at the wizard, who shrugged in reply.
"Does it return here directly after killing, or does it enjoy the night?" Royce inquired. "I should think, having been locked up in this tower for 900 years, it would want to spend some time flying about."
"It isn't a person or an animal. It's a conjuration, a mystic embodiment of power. It mimics life and understands threats to its existence, certainly, but I doubt it has any concept of pleasure or freedom. Like I said, it's not alive."
"Then why does it eat?" Royce asked.
"It doesn't."
"Then why is it killing a person or two a night?"
"I've wondered that myself. It should attempt to fulfill its last instructions, and that was clearly to kill the Emperor. It is possible that not finding its target, and not able to travel far from this tower, conjurations are often limited to a specific distance from their creator or point of origin, it might be trying to lure him here. It could have deduced that the Emperor would not tolerate the slaughter of his people and would come to aid the village."
"Regardless, we'd better be quick,"
Hadrian concluded. The wind resumed as they circled around. It whistled in their ears and buffeted their steps. The damp clothes chilled them, despite the hard work of the march. Above, the spires still rose far into the night sky, and they all felt a grim sense of drudgery when they reached yet another short bridge, which ended abruptly at a solid wall. Hadrian watched Royce sigh in disappointment as he looked at the dead end.
"I thought you said there was a door," Royce addressed the wizard.
"There was, and is." Hadrian didn't see a door. There was what appeared to be a faint outline of a door's frame etched in the wall in front of them, but it was solid stone. Royce grimaced.
"Another invisible stone portal." "Don't waste your time," Magnus told him. "You'll never open it. Trust me, I'm a dwarf. I spent hours trying to get in and nothing. That stone is enchanted and impenetrable. Crossing the river to get here was nothing compared to opening that door."
Royce turned to the dwarf with a puzzled look in his eyes.
"You've been here. You tried to enter the tower. Why?" "I told you. I was doing a job for the church."
"You said you made Lord Rufus a sword."
"I did, but the Archbishop didn't want just any sword made for him. He wanted a replica of a sword, an elfish sword. He gave me a bunch of old drawings which I used to make it. They were pretty good, with dimensions and materials listed, but it's not like being able to examine the real thing."
The dwarf's stare lingered on Royce suggestively,
I was told others of the same type could be found inside this tower. I came out here and spent all day climbing around, but never found a way in. No doors or windows, just things like this.
This sword you made, Ezra Haddon said, did it have writing on the blade?
Yep, Magnus replied. They were real insistent that the inscription on the replica was exactly like that in the books.
That's it, Ezra Haddon muttered. The church isn't here because of me, and they aren't here to find the heir. They're here to make an heir.
Make an heir? I don't get it, Hadrian said. I thought you said they wanted the heir dead.
They do, but they're going to make a puppet. This Rufus has been picked to replace the true heir. There is a legend that only the bloodline of Novron can kill a Gilarabrin. They'll use this creature's death as undisputed proof that their boy is the true heir. Not only will it provide them legitimate means to dictate laws to the kings, but it will also hinder my efforts to reinstate the real heir to power. Who will believe an old outlawed wizard when their boy slew a Gilarabrin? They'll let a few bumpkins try to fight only to die, in order to prove the invincibility of the beast. Then this Rufus will step up, and with his sword etched with the name, he'll slay it and become emperor. With Rufus as their figurehead, the church will return to power and reform the empire. Excellent move, I must say. I'll admit, I hadn't expected it.
Few moderate kings might have something to say about that, Hadrian replied.
And they know that as much as you do. They have a plan to deal with it, I'm sure.
So, do we still need to get inside? Hadrian asked.
Oh, yes, the wizard told them. Now more than ever. He chuckled. Just imagine if before their boy Rufus slays this beast, another contestant slays it first. The dwarf snorted.
Bah! I told you. You aren't getting through that door. It's solid stone.
The wizard considered the archway once more. Open it, Royce.
Royce looked skeptical. Open what? That's a wall. There's no latch, no lock, not even a seam. Anyone have a gem we can try?
This isn't a gem lock, the wizard explained.
I agree, and I would know, Magnus told them.
Try opening it anyway, the wizard insisted, staring at Royce. That's why I brought you here, remember? Royce looked at the wall before him and scowled.
How?
Use your instincts. You opened the door to my prison, and it had no latch either.
I was lucky.
You might be lucky again. Try. Royce shrugged. He stepped forward and placed his hands lightly on the stone, letting his fingertips drift across the surface, searching by feel for what his eyes might not be able to see.
This is a waste of time, Magnus said. This is clearly a very powerful lock, and without the key, there's no way to open it. I know these things. I've made these things. They are designed to prevent thieves like him from entering.
Ah, Ezra Haddon said to the dwarf. But you underestimate Royce. He's no ordinary lockpicker. I sensed it the moment I first saw him. I know he can open it. The wizard turned to Royce, who was quickly showing signs of exasperation. Stop trying to open it and just open it. Don't think about it. Just do it.
Do what?
He asked, irritated.
If I knew how, don't you think I would have opened it by now?
That's just it. Don't think. Stop being a thief. Just open the door. Royce glared at the wizard.
Fine,
he said, as he pushed his palm against the stone wall and pulled it back with a look of shock on his face. Ezra Haddon's expression was one of sheer delight.
I knew it, the wizard said. Knew what? What happened?
Hadrian asked.
I just pushed.
Royce laughed at the absurdity.
And? What do you mean, and?
Royce asked, pointing at the solid wall.
And what happened? Why are you smiling?
Hadrian studied the wall for something he missed. A tiny crack, a little latch, a keyhole, but he saw nothing. It was the same as it had always been.
It opened, Royce said.
Hadrian and the dwarf looked at Royce, puzzled.
What are you talking about?
Royce looked back over his shoulder, as if that would make everything clear.
Are you both blind? The door is standing wide open. You can see there's a corridor that...
They can't see it, the wizard interrupted. Royce looked from the wizard to Hadrian.
You can't see that the door is standing open now. You can't see this huge three-story double door.
Hadrian shook his head.
It looks just like it always has.
Magnus nodded his agreement. They can't see it because they can't enter, the wizard explained. Hadrian watched Royce look up, following the wizard's glance, and Royce's eyes widened.
What?
Hadrian asked. Elven magic, designed to prevent enemies from passing through these walls. All they see and all they will encounter is solid stone. The portal is closed to them.
You can see it?
Royce asked Ezra Haddon.
Oh, yes, quite plainly.
So why is it we can see it and they can't?
I already told you. It's magic to stop enemies from entering. As it happens, I was invited into this tower 900 years ago. It was abandoned immediately after my visit, so I'm guessing there was no one to revoke that permission. He looked back at what Hadrian still saw as solid stone. I don't think I could have opened it, though, even if I had hands. That's why I needed you.
Me, Royce said.
Then a sudden, shocked realization filled his expression, and he glared at the wizard before him.
So, you knew.
I wouldn't be much of a wizard if I didn't now, would I? Royce looked self-consciously at his own feet, then slowly turned to look cautiously at Hadrian, who only smiled.
You knew too.
Hadrian frowned.
Did you really think I could work with you all these years and not figure it out? It's a little obvious, you know.
You never said anything.
I figured you didn't want to talk about it. You guard your past jealously, pal, and you've many doors in which I don't knock. Honestly, there were times I wondered if you knew.
Knew what?
What's going on? Magnus demanded.
None of your business, Hadrian told the dwarf. But it does leave us with a parting of the ways, doesn't it?
We can't come in. And I can tell you, I'm not fond of sitting here on the doorstep waiting for the flying lizard to come home.
You should go back, Ezra Haddon told them. Royce and I can go on from here alone.
How long will this take?
Hadrian asked.
Several hours. A day, perhaps, the wizard replied.
I had hoped to be gone before it returned, Royce said.
Not possible.
Besides, this shouldn't be a problem for you, of all people. I'm certain you've stolen from occupied homes before.
Not ones where the owner can swallow me in a single bite.
So, we'll have to be extra quiet now, won't we?
Chapter 10 Lost Swords.
I thought last night went well, Bishop Salder stated, slicing himself a wedge of breakfast cheese.
He sat at the banquet table in the great hall of the manor, along with Archbishop Gallian, Sentinel Louis Skye, and Lord Rufus. The lofty cathedral ceiling of bound logs did little to elevate the dark, oppressive atmosphere caused by the lack of natural light. The entire manor had few windows, and made Saldor feel as if he were crouching in an animal's den, some woodchuck's burrow or beaver's lodge. The thought that this miserable hovel would see the birth of the new empire was a disappointment, but he was a pragmatic man. The method was irrelevant. All that mattered was the final solution. Either it worked or it did not. This was the only measure of value. Aesthetics could be added later. Right now, they needed to establish the empire. Mankind had drifted too long without a rudder. A firm hand was what the world needed, a solid grip on the wheel, with a keen set of eyes that could see into the future and direct the vessel into clear, tranquil waters. Saldor envisioned a world of peace through prosperity and security through strength. The feudal system, so prevalent across the four nations, held them back, chaining the kingdoms to a poverty of weakness and divided interests. What they needed was a centralized government with an enlightened ruler and a talented, educated bureaucracy overseeing every aspect of life. It was impossible to imagine the many goals that could be accomplished with the entire strength of mankind under one yoke. They could revolutionize farming, its fruits distributed evenly at a price that even the poorest could afford, vanquishing hunger. Laws could be standardized, eliminating arbitrary punishment by vindictive tyrants. Knowledge from the corners of the land could be gathered into a single repository where great minds could learn and develop new ideas, new techniques. They could improve transportation with standardized roads, and they could clear the stench of cities with standardized sewage systems. If all this had to begin here, in this little wood hut on the edge of the world, it was a small price to pay. "How many died?" he asked. The Archbishop shrugged, and Rufus didn't bother looking up from his plate. "Five contestants were killed by the beast last night." Louis Skye answered his question as he plucked a muffin off the table with the point of his dagger. The Knight of Nephron continued to impress Saldor. He was a sword manifested in the form of a man, sharp, pointed, cutting, and just as elegant in appearance. He always stood straight, shoulders back, chin up, eyes focused directly on his target, his face a hard, chiseled mask of contention, daring, almost begging for a confrontation from anyone fool enough to challenge him. Even after days in the wilderness, not a thread lay out of place. He was a paragon of the church, the embodiment of an ideal.
"Only five?"
"After the fifth was ripped in two, few were eager to step forward. And while they hesitated, the beast flew off."
"Do you think five deaths are sufficient to prove the beast is invincible?"
Gallian asked, looking at all of them. "No, but we may have no choice. After last night, I'm not certain any more will volunteer," Guy replied. "The previously witnessed enthusiasm for the hunt has waned."
"And will you be ready, Lord Rufus, if no one else steps forward?"
the Archbishop asked, turning to the rough warrior seated at the end of the table. Lord Rufus looked up. He was taking full advantage of the meal, chewing on a mutton leg that slicked his unruly beard with grease. His eyes stared at them from beneath the heavy hedges of his bushy red eyebrows. He spit a bit of bone out.
"That depends," he said. "This sword the dwarf made, can it cut the beastie's hide?"
"We had our scribes check the dwarf's work against the ancient records," Saldor replied. "They match perfectly with the markings recorded on previous weapons that were capable of killing beasts of this kind."
"If it can cut it, I'll kill it."
Rufus grinned a greasy smile.
"Just be ready to crown me emperor."
He bit into the leg again, and ripped a large hunk of dark meat off, filling his mouth.
Saldo could hardly believe the patriarch had chosen this oaf to be the emperor. If Guy was a sword, Rufus was a mallet, a blunt instrument of dull labour. Being a native of Trent, he would ensure the loyalty of the unruly northern kingdoms that most likely couldn't be gained any other way. That would easily double their strength going in. There was also his popularity, which extended down through Averon and Calais. This reduced the number of protests against him. The fact that he was a renowned warrior would certainly help him in his first obstacles of killing the Gilarabrin and crushing any opposition offered by the Nationalists. The problem, as Saldor saw it, was that Rufus, a rough, unreasonable dolt, had not only the heart of a warrior, but the mind as well. His answer to every problem was beating it to death. It would be hard to control him, but it made little sense to worry about the headaches of administrating an empire before one even existed. They needed to create it first, and worry about the quality of the emperor later. If Rufus became a problem, they could merely ensure that once he had a son, and once that son was safe in their custody, Rufus could meet an untimely end.
"Well, then," Galleon said, "it would seem everything is in hand."
"Is that all you called me here for?"
Guy asked with a tone of irritation.
"No," Galleon replied. "I received some unexpected news this morning, and I thought you might like to hear of it, Luis, as I suspect it will interest you very much. Carlton, will you ask the Deacon Thomas to come in?"
Galleon Stewart, Carlton, who was busy pouring watered down wine, promptly left the table and opened the door to the hallway.
"His Grace will see you now."
In walked a plump, pudgy man in a priest's frock.
"Luis Guy, Lord Rufus, let me introduce Deacon Thomas of Dahlgren Village. Thomas, this is Lord Rufus, Sentinel Guy, and you already know Bishop Saldor, of course."
Thomas nodded with a nervous smile.
"What's this all about?"
Guy asked, as if Thomas wasn't there.
"Go ahead, Thomas. Tell the sentinel what you told me."
The deacon shifted his feet and avoided eye contact with anyone in the room. When he spoke, his voice was so soft they strained to hear him.
"I was just mentioning to His Grace how I had stepped up and handled things here in the absence of the Margrave. It has been hard times in this village, hard indeed, but I tried my best to keep the great house in order. It wasn't my idea that they should invade the place. I tried to stop them, but I'm only one man, you see. It was impossible—"
"Yes, yes, tell him about the cripple,"
the Archbishop put in.
"Oh, certainly. Ah, yes, Ezra came to live here. I don't know, about a month ago. He—"
"Ezra," Guy said, and glanced abruptly at the Archbishop and Saldor, who both smiled knowingly at him.
"Yes," Deacon Thomas replied. "That's his name. He never said too much, but the villagers are a good lot, and they took turns feeding him, as the poor man was in dire straits, missing both hands as he is."
"Ezra Harden,"
Guy hissed.
"Where is the snake?"
The sudden, violent reaction of the sentinel shocked Thomas, who took a step back.
"Ah, well, I don't know. He comes and goes, although I remember he was around the village a lot more before the two strangers arrived."
"Strangers?" Guy asked.
"Friends of the Wood family, I think. At least, they arrived with Thrace and spend a lot of time with her and her father. Since they got here, Ezra spends most of his days off with the Quiet One. Royce, I think they call him."
"Royce Melbourne and Hadrian Blackwater, the two thieves that broke the wizard out of Gutara, and Ezra Harden, are all here in this village?"
Saldor and Galleon nodded at Louise.
Very curious, isn't it?
The Archbishop commented.
Perhaps we focused on the wrong hound when we approached Arista.